Buddha, to the Dharma, to the Sangha. I've talked so much and written so much over many, many years now about different aspects of the teaching and how to grow lotus blossom, that it would be easy to think that I'm utterly obsessed with that work. In actual fact, I go years at a time without even opening the book. And I go months at a time without thinking about the book or its explicit teachings. How to Grow Lotus Blossom describes something that we are doing in our training. And it contains innumerable helpful pointers about how to do the training and incredible encouragement to continue the training through even the most difficult times. It's a tremendous expression of, it embodies a tremendous expression of faith and certainty coming out of direct human experience that resulted from truly exercising faith and true resolve. In many ways over the years, I have tried to point out that there's nothing in How to Grow the Lotus Blossom that is remote from the experience that is commonly shared by all those who sincerely train in Soto Zen meditation and in the precepts. I pointed out any number of times that just a moment of true meditation contains the whole of that teaching. At the beginning of this retreat, I'd like to do a little brief rehearsal of what the essential teaching is and how to grow lotus blossom and how it is that we experience it when we truly meditate. And this is not going to be a long talk. I can do it very quickly. But let me preface by saying that we don't meditate in a vacuum. We meditate for a reason. And meditation, we do meditation because there is a need, a spiritual need. People who do a kind of meditation practice because of another motive other than a spiritual need may not experience what someone experiences when they do it out of a real spiritual need. There are lesser reasons for which people do or attempt to do meditation. We're talking here about meditating for a true spiritual purpose. This distinguishes genuine religious contemplation from health-oriented and psychologically oriented practices that people do that may have been borrowed from Buddhism, but that are not yet a fully religious practice. However, they may lead people to a religious practice. Another way of putting what I'm saying as a preface here is very simply that you cannot separate your act of meditation from your spiritual need. There's no such thing as a separation between the two. That's the beginning of how to grow a lotus blossom. It was the first of the five columns. In my need, my heart cries out to the eternal. In my need, my heart looks to something greater than myself. Even if it is an utter blindness, it gropes towards something greater than itself. Even in utter seeming blindness, it opens to something greater than itself, looking to it for help. That is the first of the five columns. That, of course, is the beginning of how to grow lotus blossom. It's what is described in the first chapters of how to grow lotus blossom. When I do that, I find out more about the nature of that need. I encounter something within myself, maybe a dark grief, it may be a bitter self-judgment, it may be a pained longing, it may be the dark, fiery edge of anger or vindictiveness, it may be bitter remorse. The deepest pain of all is always the pain of self-judgment. Whatever it is, we bring that into the meditation. It is already there. It's the need that brought us to the point of looking up to the eternal for help and crying out for help. And it is the need that we now find upon the altar of the heart in what is called the second column. See, you don't need to be seeing columns of light. Most of us don't, most of the time. What's called in lotus blossom or described as that column is within us. It has two poles. It has the one end being the eternal end, the help end, the other end being what we usually experience of as our end, being the need end. And we're experiencing these columns, which are really just one column with five aspects. We're experiencing it when we meditate, whether we know it or not. Most of the time we don't know it. I mean, why should we? We're doing it. So this second column is the column of Sangha, because there is our need, and we recognize there is a problem here, and we need help with the problem. And when we recognize there's a problem here and that we need help with the problem, and we say, please help me with this problem, and as soon as we do that, the help is working on it. Well, that's the second column. That's called the washing. Why is it washing? Because there's cleaning going on. You know, our heart is softening in this stage. The heart is softening. That which has been hardened and encrusted with pain, impacted with pain, is softening. And even if it is dark, it is moving in the direction of brightness. And as this happens, and it takes place over time, in seemingly little ways, it may be taking place in a matter of over a very short time, or it may be happening very quietly over a long period of time. But it happens over time. And as that softening of the heart happens, so does certainty grow within us. Yes, this is the path to the cessation of suffering. Yes, there is that which helps. Yes, that which in me, however dark the need, however confused, however anguished, it can be help, and it is never fundamentally separate from the source of that help. Ultimately, it's just our own opinions of ourselves, just the shadows that stand in the way or seem to do so. And as this certainty comes, that is the third column. And you see there's a perfectly logical progression happening. So as the need receives the help of the eternal and the help provided by our own willingness, our own faith and willingness, our own humility, willingness to get out of the way and let the eternal work on it. Stop thrashing around, be still, take refuge in the eternal. Then joy begins to spring up. And we recognize with gratitude the role that the love of the eternal is playing in our lives. And its course through our body and mind. And that is the fourth column. Then we realize that all along the eternal's been the one in charge of this whole thing. Think for a moment. Imagine that you're at the airport and you're on one of those, now I'm assuming that most people who are listening to me have at some point been on one of those moving walkways that they have at the airport. It's kind of like an escalator, only it's flat. Imagine that you're on one of these moving walkways and that you're standing still on it. Well, the whole point of it is that especially at the really big airports, that they have these things that go on in places like Amsterdam and other really big airports. Imagine that you're standing still on it, you've got all your luggage with you. The idea is to help you move over long distances carrying a whole bunch of luggage. And some of these things go on for hundreds of feet, then have a little break, then another one starts up for hundreds more feet. So even once you're on that, even though you're not taking any steps at all, it's transporting you. That's the way the eternal works. Even if you're not doing anything at all, it's transporting you. If you were to turn around and walk the other way, it would still be transporting you. But you would be going against its flow. And the willful breakage of the precepts, willful greed, hate, and delusion, that's like walking against the, it's like walking the wrong way on the moving walkway of life. You can see how tiring that must be. How tiring that is, how fatiguing that is, and how self-defeating it is. Even if you make some progress going the wrong direction, as soon as you stop, it starts pulling you back to itself. You see? As soon as you stop, it'll start pulling you back to itself. And right there is a little simple explanation how it is that evil is always vanquished and good prevails. Because soon as the effort, and it takes a great effort in the end, to sustain going the wrong direction, but as soon as that effort flags and one stops still for even a second, one's being whisked in the other direction, back towards the eternal. So you could say that life is set up so that we will fail to succeed at spiritually failing. In the long run, no one can succeed at spiritual failure. You know, people think that they're succeeding at the success of self, but the success of self would be spiritual failure. But life is set up in such a way that we're all on this moving walkway returning back to the eternal, and you can't succeed at spiritual failure. When you choose to not try to succeed at spiritual failure, that is the first column, whether you know it or not. That's where you consciously start to ask for help and to look to that which is greater than yourself for help. And as soon as you do that, you start to awaken spiritually. And all the rest of it is just to more and more allow yourself to be born back without resisting it. And so the whole of the spiritual life unfolds from the initial turning to the eternal for help. The fifth column is just the whole lot in one. The others never were separate. There only ever was one column. And that is, could be very simply described, all beings possess the Buddha nature. The eternal is. If you look and see a great multiplicity of living things and worlds and realms of existence and atoms and molecules, etc., etc., there's many ways to describe the multiplicity. If you look and just see the multiplicity, you're seeing the whole body of that fifth column without necessarily recognizing that it's all one body. If you see that multiplicity and recognize that it's all expressing one eternal love and one eternal reality and one eternal truth, then you are seeing the fifth column in its multitudinous aspects, infinite variety, and yet there's only one reality. And when in meditation itself we simply relax into stillness and entrust the whole of our body and mind to that stillness, looking up within it, then the reality of the eternal simply is, and we are just an aspect of that reality. Our body and mind is just aspects of that reality. So you could say, to put it in theological sounding terms, that God reclaims every part of itself, or himself or herself or itself, and that our practice of meditation, our practice of the precepts, our practice of training is just giving ourselves wholly to that reclaiming.